Blog Talk Radio.
Ah, I figured it out. That's the voice of Princess Kate. This is her side gig because her father-in-law isn't paying for anything anymore. Oh, no, wrong guy. Okay. Good morning, everybody. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I'm a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, soon to have a new name. And I'm here with, and let me do the disclaimer real fast. Anything that I say or anybody says on this program is their opinion and only their opinion, not necessarily the opinion of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty at large or individually. And now, here's Brendan.
Oh,
hi, Brendan.
Oh, man.
That's a great intro.
I should be the one saying, here's Jeff.
Here's Brendan. By the way, Brendan is Brendan Beery. He is a professor of law at, guess what, WMU Cooley Law School. If you've been listening, you knew that answer. You get a point. Mm-hmm. Okay? Okay.
We
work together. Our offices are actually right next door to each other. Mm-hmm. We've been thinking about punching a hole through, and you know, so we don't have to talk on the phone so much. Okay, kind of things that we're planning on doing, but we just never seem to get around to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. We don't have to remodel. We're moving. Okay, you understand?
Yeah.
We're moving. Okay, but we're not supposed to talk about that. Okay. about that, James.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to talk about that. Good morning, Marilyn. I hope you're having a nice morning. Marilyn had a wonderful weekend. She went dancing a lot, and she had her 45-year-old daughter. I'm not supposed to be 45. Her 45-year-old daughter down here to celebrate Mother's Day, going back and forth to the beach and having all kinds of fun. Okay.
Fun.
And I learned a lesson Sunday night. We were over at Pasta Grill, which people go to Pasta Grill will know this, but in front of the house where we were hanging out, there's a lot of street parking. And I'm looking down at the street, and we get there about maybe 5:30, and there's a guy who left his flashers on. And it's just yellow flashing, okay? And about 8:15, 8:30, some 3.5 hours later, after the sun goes down, they come out, and they start packing all their stuff up in their car. And I say, you're going to turn off those flashers, aren't you? And he looks up at me like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's standing in the back of the car. They're flashing in front of 4 or 5 people getting ready to get in this car. And somehow or another, the flashers are completely lost to them. Okay? So they go to get in the car. Can anybody guess what happened when they got in the car?
Oh, God.
Okay. The battery was dead. The battery was dead.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they go to start the car. Everything shuts down. Even the flashers. I mean, it just shuts down. And so the guy parked next to him, apparently, was like this guy's best friend. And he walks over and he sees us sitting out on the patio here. Not the patio. It's not a patio. It's like an overhang porch kind of thing on the second floor. And he looks up and he says, sir. Okay, I love being called sir. He goes, sir, do you have any jumper cables? Which, of course, they were in the back of Marilyn's car. So I said, yeah, I got some jumper cables. Just sitting down to eat. Okay. So I go downstairs. I get the jumper cables. I learned something about young people. Anybody under the age of 35? They haven't got the foggiest idea what you do with jumper cables. They know you need them.
Right.
But they got no idea what you're supposed to do with these things.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the old fart, you know, the boomer says, well, okay, you got to move your car over here and get it closer. And I said, here, we got to attach them to the battery. And they're looking for the battery. So, okay, flash, well, you got to shine a light. Which one's the positive? Which one's the positive?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So
I attach them. And then I go to attach them to the other car. And when I touch the ground, it sparks. That tells me it's a problem.
Oh.
So I switched them around because the other car was clear, which was positive and negative, and I hook them up. And they look at me like, what now? What now? I said, you, get in that car. Race the engine. You, get in that car. Start the car. Okay?
Yep.
I'm supposed to start the car. It won't start. I said, I think it'll start now. Give it a shot. Okay? Car starts right up. Okay?
Yeah.
And they're cheering and they're laughing. That was great. Thanks a lot, sir. I really appreciate it. No freaking idea what was going on. Okay.
Yeah.
I said, and I looked at the driver of the car that was dead. I said, now listen to me carefully. Turn the flashers off. Because they were still on. I said, turn the flashers off. Don't turn off your car till you get home for any reason. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then tomorrow morning, hopefully there'll be enough of a charge in it. It'll start. You need to take it over someplace and get it fully charged. I didn't want to discourage him by saying it could really be dead, in which case, you know, going to spend $65 on a new battery. I wasn't going to ruin his day. He was really happy that the car started. I didn't want to ruin it. He was in a good mood. And I just said, and they're all going, thank you, sir, thank you, sir. And they're shaking my hand. And they're I just want to go eat my dinner. Okay?
Yeah, right.
I disconnect them, sir, and I get back up there, and they drive away. I mean, I just learned that these, you know, no sackle. Okay, another Jiddish word. Sackle means street sense. No sackle at all. Okay, zero. Okay? So be that as it may. That's my funny story for the day. That was my Sunday evening. I went back and ate my food, okay? And that's when my phone got ruined on the way home, okay? But we're not going to talk about how my phone died, okay?
Yeah,
and why it
died.
Okay, we're not going to talk about, you know, it being set into a glass with watermelon juice for a half an hour, okay?
That'll do
that
it.
Just killed it. That did it. There was nothing that was going to save that phone. Okay, all the rice in the world was not going to save that phone. Okay, so there you go. All
it sounds like during that little episode, if they called you sir one more time, you would have started confusing yourself for Donald Trump, right? I mean, you know. Sir.
No, I would have put him in.
Sir.
I would have put him in uniforms and made them stand up and they did close drill or something. Don't call me sir. When I was in the military, I was an enlisted man. I worked for a living. Don't call me sir. Okay, my son gets called sir. He's a colonel. That's okay. He's entitled to it. Okay? He earned it. No. I just thought it was just, these guys had, like, no idea what to do. They just knew they needed jumper cables. They would have blown up both batteries if they had done this themselves. And I'd be looking at fires and people getting injured. Okay? They just had no idea. It was awful. Okay. That's my comment on the XYZ generations, okay? I don't know what letter we're on. Do we flip over to AA and BB now, generations? Is that what we do?
Right.
The next generation is the AA generation. I have no idea what it means. Okay, so, all right, we're going to start. We got to start talking about serious stuff now. I can't sit here and do a comedy routine for an hour. What I want to talk about and what I want to start with is going to be fairly short. And that is that I am tired of hearing about the total cluster, you know what, of the town hall with Donald Trump and Caitlin Collins, okay? I'm really tired of hearing about it. Donald Trump did not disappoint. He was everything he was supposed to be and more. And that's not a bad thing. It really isn't a bad thing because every single one of those independent voters who voted against him in 2020 and voted against his candidates in 2022 and voted against him in 2018, all of those suburban mothers, all of those African-American people, all of those immigrants, all of those middle-of-the-road voters that he needs to win, were reminded that night about why they didn't like this guy. I have no problem with that. Okay? So to that extent, CNN, thank you. I don't like the idea that you let him use your air to push his grievances and all of his xenophobia and all of his racism and all of his complaints. Okay? I don't like that. But to the same extent, it did some good. As far as Caitlin is concerned, I have all the respect in the world for a woman who is 30 or 31 years old, only been in this business for a short time, who has risen so fast. She shows sheer talent. But she was in over her head. And if he would, and if he was responsible for picking her in order to do this, CNN should have said, no, we pick our own moderator. Don't like it? You get Allison Camerota. You get Dana Bash. You don't even get Anderson Cooper because he's a little weak at times. And I'm sorry. I just, Caitlin, you're very talented, and I respect you a great deal. You were as tough as anybody at the White House. But you are an anchor now, and you have softened. And I am not impressed. You need more work. You're getting better, but you need more work. So I'm tired of hearing about this and all the things that go with it, okay? We knew who he was. He's telling us who he is, and he is rallying his people. He is the insurrectionist candidate. No ifs, ands, or buts about it, and he's telling you, I am going to destroy this government. I'm going to ally myself with the Russians. I want nothing to do with NATO. I am going to change the world order because it's going to make me richer. And he's telling you this. So, I, if he wants to say that, let him say it. I really want him to say it. It's okay. But he's a coward because he didn't show up in Iowa this weekend because Ronnie was there. Ronnie, we're going to talk about later. So I'm tired of hearing about it. Don't want to hear about it anymore. It's over. It's done. And it's not going to happen again. It's just not. And if he got to pick who he wants, I guarantee you whoever does the town hall is not going to pick Allison Camerota, is not going to pick Dana Bash. They're going to pick Anderson Cooper, who throws a lot of softballs, or somebody else who throws softballs. They're not going to pick John King to do it, that's for sure. But they should be able to choose their person and do the same thing, just run the clock. If you're going to be fair, make sure that – and they get to load up the audience like Donald did.
Mm-hmm.
That was all just false advertising. It was all just switch and bait. Bait and switch. Okay? Told us it was going to be a lot of independents, and it turned out to be nothing but so-called independents and Republicans, all of whom voted for Donald in 16 and 20. What did they think they were going to get? So that was, that was just a loss. That was just a bad leader. So I'm done with that. Let's not talk about it anymore. We're done. But you can comment if you want to.
Well,
I'd like to hear what you have to say.
The clapping seals was the most disgusting part of that whole fiasco. I agree with you. I mean, Trump was Trump. Trump said everything you would think he was going to say. He was probably even uglier than usual. I think the more time goes on, the more there's something going on with his brain chemistry that gets him more and more toxic and unhinged. So, I mean, there was no surprise there. It's just sickening to hear actual Americans cheer that on, that mindless dribble. These people have to be so compromised. I use that word all the time to talk about these folks. That's the part that bothered me the most. And as you say, CNN, if you're gonna have a town hall with Donald Trump, that's fine. But don't give him a campaign rally, for crying out loud. I'm trying my best not to drop F-bombs this morning. I'm feeling really grumpy. When I get grumpy, I start to curse a lot. So I've got the sailor's mouth. By the way, you know why I'm grumpy? I got to vent a little bit about something mundane before I get into my what I really think. I've got repair people coming tomorrow. I moved into this house 18 months ago. And I'm the first person who's ever lived in this house. And that means, of course, that all the GE appliances are brand new. I've been rifling through the paperwork, in the drawers here, looking for the stuff about the appliances. And lo and behold, it looks like all of them had 1-year warranty. or things going wrong, right? I guess that must be a standard because that's all I can find. But it's a few days ago, I noticed that the refrigerator, you know, I got something out of the refrigerator and it was lukewarm. It wasn't very cold. So, and the freezer, the same thing. The freezer, things are starting to thaw a little bit. And I've tried everything. I've looked at the user's manual, whatever. And no, the thing, it just is starting, it's slowly heating up to the point where now this morning the refrigerator is 51 degrees. I'm going to have to throw everything out that's in there. So that happened. Then I go to use the GE dishwasher 2 days ago. Guess what? It runs for 5 minutes and then it stops. It runs for five. It will not run. Then I go to my GE laundry machine. I'm washing my bedding, and several hours after I put that in there and started the machine, I go back in, and guess what? It's full of water still, so it hasn't spun out. Do they literally create their appliances to all fail at 18 months? I am absolutely,
probably.
I'm pulling my hair out. I mean, how is this possible? One after the other, these appliances just stop working. 18 months. Anyway, I got to get that. So I had to get off my chest. There's nothing funny about that story. I apologize.
There's literally nothing funny about that story.
No,
I want you to know that. There's literally nothing funny.
But I want everybody to know why I'm so...
I want to make sure you know that.
Yeah. I just want everybody to know why I'm so foul this morning.
You know, the saving grace, Brandon, though, is that you only have to call up one mechanic.
That's true.
Yeah. Mechanic.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
You only pay for one service call.
That's it.
Exactly.
That's, yep. They're going to let me know tonight.
Only Hezzy would think of that. Very good.
Yep.
You found the silver lining around the dark cloud. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
My apologies.
Okay. Because usually people describe me as being the guy that finds the dark cloud inside the silver lining.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
Okay. So I like that thought process. Very good. Okay. So, no, I got nothing to say about that because, you know, what am I going to make you feel better? I'll just leave you where you're at.
Okay. Oh, my God.
All right. So we can pick up. There were a whole bunch of things we were going to talk about. Do we want to talk about
it? Let me tee one up for you. Let me tee it up for you.
Here we go. So first tee. Now on the first tee. Okay, good.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, we got the PGA Championship coming up, so why not? The Comers, I think you said his name. I think that's right. The chair of whatever committee. Is all in on trying to find the dirt on Joe Biden and his family. And they have been tossing around just unbelievably reckless accusations. They don't have a single document. They don't have a single piece of testimonial evidence that's credible. They've got nothing. And yet they're throwing around all kinds of Republicans, of course, I'm talking about, all kinds of allegations about the Biden family being, you know, on the take of all kinds of foreign, you know, influence and whatnot. And in a recent interview, this guy, the head Republican of this committee that's making all these allegations, is asked to produce any evidence. And he says, well, our informant is missing. And, you know, 9 out of 10 people who are our whistleblowers and our informants, they're either in court or they're in jail or they've gone missing. And of course, you know, the Fox News reaction to this is, well, that must be a new conspiracy, right? See, Biden's offing all these people, right? he's supposedly senile and demented, right? But he's sharp enough to pull off, right, this elaborate scheme to off all of his political enemies, right, and whistleblowers.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I mean that makes a whole lot of sense. But you know, I just want to say before I turn this over to you, because I know you got some thoughts about this. But there's a reason why you can't find any dirt on Joe Biden, and there's a reason why you don't even have to turn over a rock before you find it on Donald Trump. And the reason is that Donald Trump is corrupt and Joe Biden is not. you know, when are Republicans just going to learn that just you're just going to have to live with that? He's a nice person. He's not a pig. He's not a slime. He doesn't treat people like trash. He's not corrupt.
Everybody loves Uncle Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't what?
He's your Uncle Joe. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's who he is.
Keep looking. Yeah,
I'm
keep
sorry.
Looking, Republicans. Right. Good luck.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, the idea, the guy, they had an informant. That's what they called him. He wasn't even a whistleblower. He's an informant. And the informant happens to be an Israeli college professor. That's his day job. His other job is arms dealer. Somehow or another, I think it's the other way around. I think the professorship is a cover that the Israeli – I think he's a Mossad agent. I think they gave him a cover of being a professor. Okay? He's like, how can I put – remember Professor Moriarty from, Holmes. Sherlock Holmes. He was a professor. Yeah, he was some sort of professor at Cambridge. But he was an arms dealer, and he was a bad guy. Yeah, the Mossad's got their own, Professor Moriarty, I guess. And so this guy apparently gets arrested in some place in Eastern Europe, if I'm not incorrect. Cyprus. On Cyprus. And he bonds himself out, and he disappears. Nobody seems to know where this guy is. The Israelis don't know where he is. Bull. The Israelis don't know where he is. Nobody knows where he is. And he's an arms dealer. I mean, he's looking at going to prison forever. But somehow Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Hunter Biden's laptop all got together and conspired to off this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's why he's disappeared.
Right.
There's no real logical thing like he has lots of money and he disappears because he's an arms dealer and he disappeared because he didn't want to go to jail. You know, that's not logical. Why would that be logical? It's more logical that Joe Biden had him killed. Okay? I mean,
right.
That's the implication. I mean,
right.
I'm sitting there trying,
right.
What? I mean, these guys have got to start writing a book.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah. Seriously.
I really have no idea where Comer's going with any of this. He says he's got whistleblowers, but the whistleblowers don't seem to be around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lawyer that I read an article. I can't remember his name now. There's a lawyer who represents all these whistleblowers. It's supposed to be the whistleblower, what do we call it, the maven. And he says, these guys don't disappear. If they really exist, they don't disappear. And the reason why they don't disappear is because they've already made themselves public. What reason would they have to disappear? And the guy who was inside the IRS is nowhere to be found. That's because he never really existed.
Mm-hmm.
They get a letter from somebody who writes a bunch of crap, claims to be someone who works inside the IRS, and when they go to find him, he's nowhere to be found, which means he was probably never with the IRS. There's a special prosecutor, the DOJ has been working on Hunter Biden exactly like they were supposed to. Garland has kept his hands off of it completely. They've investigated everything everybody has to say about him. There's no question the guy was a drug dealer. Or not a dealer, but a drug user. There's no question that he got paid a lot of money by Barista or whatever the name of the company was from Ukraine, which was actually Russian, dealing in oil dealing. And he made a lot of money. No, he got a lot of money for it. No question about it. Spent it all. Didn't report it to the IRS. He owes a lot of money to the IRS. They got him on tax evasion. They made him on tax fraud. And something having to do with the illegal purchase or sale of a gun. That's all they got. And he's going to get indicted. He's going to get charged, and he'll be sentenced appropriately. Someone said to me, how can he be proud of his of his – Biden be proud of his son? How can he say, I'm proud of my son? It's real simple. He's proud of his son because he's clean now, because he's trying to deal with all of his problems. He's got a lawyer who's dealing straight up with the government about all the things that are going on. He's proud of the way he's handling himself now. And on top of which, he's his kid. What do you want to say? My kid's a stunk, and I hate him, and I've disowned him, and I want nothing to do with him. Really? That's going to happen. Okay? Your kid does something awful when he's a kid, but you call him, you say, I'm proud of him. Now I'm proud of him. Okay. I have no problem. What are you supposed to do, disown the kid? They haven't got the first dime going to any kind of. They've looked at this committee, by the way, has seen all of the bank accounts. They can't find one dime going to anybody in the Biden family except for Hunter. They're looking for money going from Hunter to his father. Can't find a dime. Nothing. And then what's her name? Mates, I think her last name is. The congresswoman who wants to look like some middle of the road holds a press conference yesterday and says, DOJ's got to get off it. And I'm quoting, DOJ's got to get off their ass and start investigating and indicting and convicting and sentencing these people. What people? She doesn't specify what people. She doesn't specify what for. And if it's the Durham report, if there was something in the Durham report for them to indict and charge, excuse me, that was why he was a special prosecutor. If the evidence was there, he would have. The two cases he handled, massive failures, 10-minute not guilty verdicts. If he had it, he would have charged it. But instead he says, here, Congress, you go after him. I couldn't find it with all my subpoena power and grand jury, but you try now. Mm-hmm. That's his report, by the way. So I'm sorry. I don't want to hear this stuff. I mean, they just want somebody to get indicted who's a Democrat. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to find all these bad guys who were inside the Obama administration. There wasn't one scandal in that entire administration. They were mm-hmm. so squeaky clean they could have done Clorox commercials. He couldn't find anything. One of them spit on a sidewalk once. Okay. Indicted for a misdemeanor spitting on a sidewalk, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. That whole thing is such a farce. And Garland is smart. He's not saying a word about it. Not one word. And if someone says, are you going to investigate? He's going to say, that was his job. And he indicted people. I didn't squash any indictments. I didn't quash any indictments. I let him go to trial if he wanted to. He got his ass creamed, but we let him go to trial. If he had other cases, he was free to charge him. So he hasn't got anything. There's nothing in the report. There was nothing stopping him from charging people. It's a farce. It's 300 pages of utter and complete nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Stop already. Yeah. Why don't you stop governing instead of causing trouble?
Yeah. Well, there's an idea. With what agenda? Somebody find their agenda, then they'll start governing.
Yeah. What was our agenda? Oh, yeah, to bankrupt the country. That's our agenda.
Yeah.
And then blame it
there you go.
And then blame it on Biden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
no.
You know, it's interesting. It's like they're – because they do seem – sometimes Republicans, they seem so frustrated that it seems like some of them actually really think, right, that Hunter must be paying off, must be paying off Pops. And it's like they assume that everybody is as corrupt as them, right? You know, no, that was the last family in the White House, okay? I mean, Don Jr. and Eric and all these, right, jokers and all the business that they were up to their eyeballs in, the Russian money and God knows what else. That's – and Trump as the mob boss, obviously. I mean, that's not everybody's like that. But the Republicans are so conditioned to expect, explicit corruption that they just can't, they don't seem, some of them obviously know that Joe Biden is not corrupt, right? He's not corruptible. But some of them seem to really think that he must be, just because everybody is. And what a testament that is to the types of people that we're dealing with here, right? I mean, they themselves are so corrupt that they can't believe that anybody isn't. And they're so conditioned to accept it that they can't believe there's anybody. Anybody can rise to that level of power without being corrupt. As you say, this is the second Democratic president in a row, because Barack Obama, God knows, they tried everything they could to find something on him. And I'll say it again. There's nothing there. That's why you can't find it.
Republicans like to say, there's no there.
Right. Yeah.
I've never understood that, but that's okay. It just really boggles the imagination that they – if they want to find a child of a of a president who is corrupt and made a living off of being who that person is, she's down in Miami-Dade County, mm-hmm. living in Miami Beach right now, building a house in one of the most exclusive places in all of the country, let alone Florida. Go talk to her
mm-hmm.
about patents in China.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to her about her dealings with the Chinese government. Talk to her sitting in the president's chair and representing this country where she had no business being, so she could have private conversations with Xi Jinping. Okay, go talk to her. Go talk to her husband about the $2 billion loan he just got from the Saudis for protecting their ass and getting them out from killing Khashoggi. Talk to Donald about LIV Golf and all the tournaments that they're paying him multi-millions of dollars to hold at his golf courses. That's where you need to go. Stop looking at Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe's got a couple million dollars. That's it. And he made it from a book he wrote. That's all he's got. He's got a nice house, but he's been living in it for 35 years. Uncle Joe don't have much in comparison to others. Stop looking at the Clintons for the millions and tens of millions of dollars they made writing books and giving speeches. Stop looking at Obama. He wrote 5 books. Then his wife wrote a book, all bestsellers. We know where their money came from. Want to know? And Hunter Biden saying, this is where my money came from. Here it is. Here's my bank accounts. That's what I did. Stop trying to make something out of it that it doesn't exist. I'm done. I don't want to hear it. Go govern. Do something really important. You know, like, I don't know, save the country from defaulting and destroying everybody in this country, every company in this country, making the only people that are going to make money off of a default are very rich people who are going to be able to buy savings bonds that are now going to pay 10% instead of 3% because that's the best we can do to sell off our debt. But we can't pay the service, so buy the bonds, but we're not going to pay the debt service. Yeah, that's what I'm going to buy. I'm going to buy a bond that doesn't pay me my interest as the Chinese come after us and other governments come after us. Yeah, this is really smart. Yeah, okay. Go govern. Lead me along. But what do I really think? Let's talk. Before we run out of time, okay, let's talk about Ronnie. Because Ronnie's mm-hmm. really important. Okay? And he hates being called Ronnie, which is why I call him Ronnie. And for those of you who don't know who Ronnie is Governor Ronald DeSantis. I want to say Ronald McDonald DeSantis, but I didn't say that. Ronnie's a very dangerous guy. A very, very dangerous man. He is a fascist. He does what fascists do. He has turned Florida into a fascist state in every sense of the word. And he is about to declare for president of the United States. He has moved his office from the Republican Party headquarters in Tallahassee to a campaign office that he has rented, and they're moving into it, although there's no sign in the front. They've moved all of their operations into this one place, which I'm sure is owned by some big donor, okay, who said, sure, you can use it rent-free. There's a lot going on with him, and we will get to Disney because I want to talk about Iger. But the first thing I want to talk about is this whole don't say gay, which they've now expanded from third grade up to 12th grade. You cannot talk about certain what they refer to as special subject matters. Okay? Special subjects. These special subjects are special topics. And what the Department of Education for the state looks at, in particular when they're reviewing textbooks, is they look for critical race theory applications. Do the materials talk about prohibited critical race theory in instructional materials? They then look for culturally responsive teaching. Do the instructional materials omit culturally responsive teaching? In other words, do we talk about African-American studies? Do we talk about Japanese studies? Do we talk about anything but white Christian studies? And if we do, that's prohibited. Social justice. Do instructional materials omit social justice as it relates to critical race theory? We do not talk about slavery. We do not talk about civil rights. We do not talk about Martin Luther King. We do not talk about incidents of race-related actions that were taken, like Black Lives Matter, after things like the Floyd killing or others. Social-emotional learning. Do instructional materials not solicit social-emotional learning? What they mean by that is we don't want our white children feeling bad about themselves because we used to have slavery and because black people struggled for over 100 years just for the ability to vote, even though there was a constitutional amendment. We aren't going to talk about the 13th Amendment. We're not going to talk about the 15th Amendment and what brought them about because we don't want our young white children feeling bad for black children. We don't want black children or other colored children, and when I say other colored, I mean people of color, to feel bad or learn about themselves. We don't want to know about their history. They shouldn't want to know about their history. They should want to learn about white Christian America history. In other words, DeSantis is rewriting history. He doesn't want learning about Holocaust because that's going to make Christians feel bad for the Jews. And besides, it'll be easier for us to do it to the Jews again if nobody understands what the Holocaust was in the first place or how it worked. Mm-hmm. That's the guy that wants to be president of the United States. That's who Ron DeSantis is. Now, two incidents. The first thing is there was a Florida teacher who is now under investigation for violating the law about don't say gay. No, nothing about gay people. We don't talk about gay people like they don't exist. We don't want our children to know that gay people exist. We don't want our high school people to know that gay exists. Not allowed to talk about it. So if you've got a gay kid in high school and he kills himself, it's because it's like he doesn't exist, or it's okay to pick on him or her. So she apparently had a fifth grade class. It wasn't even, I thought it was kindergarten. It's a fifth grade class. And what she did is that she showed a Disney movie featuring a gay character, but she said she wasn't aware that the law had exceeded third grade at the time that she did it. But what she did was she sent in 2022, she played a movie called Strange World to a classroom of fifth graders while their peers were finishing some standardized testing. It's a story about a family of explorers, but the main character is a young biracial male who identifies as being gay. There's one reference to it in the entire movie. The teacher said the student's parents had previously signed permission slips allowing the children to watch PG-rated movies. This is a PG-rated movie. One parent complained and reported the teacher to the Department of Education after the movie was shown. Why? Because this parent happens to be a member of the Board of Education for Hernando County. She signed a permission slip. But her kid came home and said, well, the main character is gay, you know, homosexual. And she was horrified. So what did she do? She raised the issue in front of the Board of Education. Parents found out about it. The kids were talking about it among themselves, sent something to the parents, and now all the parents want this teacher gone. All of a sudden, they're upset. Who made it a big deal? Who made it something that was important? Well, her name is Karen Jordan. Of course her name is Karen. She's a Karen. Her name is Karen Jordan. She's on the Hernando County School Board, and she's the one that made the big deal out of it. Otherwise, it wasn't a big deal. And I'm sorry, wait a minute. No, Karen Jordan was the spokesman. I'm sorry, the spokesman for Hernando. The board member's name is Sharon Rodriguez. Okay? And said that she should have gotten permission for that specific movie, not just a general GP or PG, that because and said the teacher's playing the victim. Her quote was, it's not a teacher's job to impose their beliefs upon a child, religious, sexual orientation, gender identity, any of the above. But allowing movies such as this assist teachers in opening the door. And please hear me, they assist teachers in opening a door for conversations that have no place in our classrooms. Really? Impose their beliefs. What belief was imposed? Nothing was imposed. When she spoke to CNN, the teacher said that students were already discussing those kind of topics on their own, without her participation, for which she said, go talk to your parents. They see things on TV. They talk to older kids. Those words get passed around. They understand what those things are in fifth grade. The teacher also said that Rodriguez's insistence that the individual movie needed to be approved, that there was no protocol for that. And that Rodriguez's daughter had signed a form approving the showing of PG movies. Now, this teacher has already resigned from the public schools before the incident occurred due to politics and the fear of being able to be who you are. That's not good enough for these people. They want her teaching certificate. They don't want her ever teaching in the state of Florida, ever anywhere. She's a horrible, terrible person. And her students are asking, what's so wrong? Why is this, quote, inappropriate, close quote? Why are you in so much trouble? Because of this little part of the movie. And her response has to be, I don't know. Go ask your parents. That's what's happened. Now, here's the quote of the day. Rodriguez, the member of the school board, says, as a leader in this community, I'm not going to stand by and allow this minority to infiltrate our schools. God put me here for that purpose. She was put on the school board because that's where God wanted her. God help us. The last thing is this stuff I was talking about, the other CRT stuff. They are rejecting passages in textbooks about the Holocaust. They're rejecting textbooks that even make a mention of George Floyd. They rejected 30 social studies textbooks and are demanding edits on 47 others. Because they're not on the recommended list now. These are the things that they're doing. It's okay for pictures of children showing showing affection for each other. Of all of those pictures, there's one white child and one black child, girls, actually pulling on the ends of a doll. Like they're fighting over it. That's okay. That's okay. These special topics are they talk about. Social studies alive, my school and family. Discourages showing the story of Vicente Martinez Ybor. For those in Florida, we know about Ybor City, which is was a kind of Cuban community that was created in Tampa where all the cigar rollers were, all the cigar companies. Ybor City is a big place now, but they don't want that story told. Some of the other special topics, studies alive, social studies alive, America's past. The book explores harsh treatment of Native Americans and Chinese railroad workers in the 19th century. That's a special topic. We don't make white people feel bad about themselves, about things that happened 200 years ago or 150 years ago. Gateway to early American history. They don't specify, but two of the topics were not acceptable. They said it was controversial because Christopher Columbus was enumerated as starting slavery in North America. By taking slaves out of North America. Civics Alive foundations sit there and say things over, you know, the book stresses the advantages of the federal system of government and the benefits of capitalism and free markets when compared to government-controlled economic systems elsewhere. They consider that a special topic because what does DeSantis stand for? He stands for government control over everything. Who you can do business with, who you can't do business with, how you do business. And if you are Disney, keep your mouth shut and just do what you are told. Now, going back to Disney, because I do want to say something about this. I have said that I thought that Disney is, if they lose this battle over their special taxing district, one of 2,000 of them in the state of Florida, which development districts, we give them special tax districts like this, 2,000 of them in this state. How about the villages, this bastion of right-wing politics is a special district. Are they going after them? No. Did they go after Disney? Well, Bob Iger has laid the foundation for leaving. He was giving a speech to a group. Quote, our plans were to invest $17 billion over the next 10 years. $17 billion. That's more than a whole year's budget in the state of Florida. $17 billion over the next 10 years, which is what the state should want us to do. He says, we operate responsibly. We pay our fair share of taxes, $1 billion a year. We employ thousands, about 20,000 people, not to mention the people who work peripherally to have their jobs because Disney is here. We pay them above the minimum wage. We give them employee benefits and wages substantially higher than those dictated by the state, including paying college tuition for the people that work for them to go to what? Florida colleges. He concluded by the following question. Does the state want us to invest more, employ more people, and pay more taxes or not? By saying that, he's saying not only are we not going to invest, but we have to consider leaving. His statement came in response to a question from a financial analyst who suggested that the company was stuck with this fight and asked about the company's future risk. Iger and his colleagues at the entertainment giant have second thoughts about their investment in Florida. If they don't expand and they don't grow, they're not staying. He would not, Iger wouldn't give interviews over this, nor would DeSantis' people talk about it. Iger said that Disney had enjoyed a terrific relationship with the state for more than 50 years and never expected to be in the position of having to defend our business interests in federal court. There is no question in my mind that he is seriously considering leaving. I'll give you another special district, Daytona Speedway. Who are the fans of NASCAR? I don't even have to give you a hint.
Mm-hmm.
They have a special taxing district for Daytona to protect NASCAR in Daytona, in Volusia County. There are no special tax breaks for these people. They just have control over how their tax money is spent to the benefit of everybody and everything around them. He's leaving. If DeSantis doesn't back off, Disney World will be gone. Might take 8, might take 9 years, but they're leaving. And if you don't think they're buying up land in North Carolina or in Georgia, then you're not giving Disney the benefit of how they became Disney World in Florida in the first place. DeSantis, you are a disaster. You are a racist. You are a misogynist. You are xenophobic. You are everything this country abhors, everything this country abhors. And you have no business being the president of the United States. None. And if you win, my money, me and my family are going to be gone. Jews will flee this country so fast it'll make your head spin. Never forget, and we haven't, because we know we're next. We're not stupid. And don't think we are. I'm done with that now. If you want to talk about something else.
Well, that's...
Or this.
One thing I did want to talk about that you hit on. I want to think about the human cost and the human element of this for a minute. The big uproar that you talked about... over this, you know, biracial gay character in a Disney movie that's rated PG. I want to think for a minute what that does, that uproar, those statements that were made by a board member or members, what that does to the teenager who has been taught their entire life by their conservative parents that the worst thing you could be is gay, who's been struggling with that already, who is already loathing themselves because they believe what they've been taught in their churches or in their whatever religion they adhere to, and by their parents and by their aunts and uncles and by their culture. What does it say to that kid when the mere appearance of somebody like them in a movie gives rise to this kind of uproar among all the grown-ups around you? They're all talking about, you know, let's assume that this person is in the closet, because for crying out loud, why would you, why wouldn't you be at that age, in that environment, hiding, depressed, as I said, self-loathing. And now the message that's being sent to you is your existence or the existence of people like you, it cannot even be uttered. It cannot even be acknowledged. These people are going to have the blood of teenagers on their hands. You mentioned suicide. There is no group of young people who commit suicide at a faster clip than people who are young kids who are struggling with their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And this is the pro-life, right? This is the pro-life party. Telling these kids that your life, who you are, your existence, cannot even be, as I said, cannot even be uttered or recognized. Not you. You're the other. You quoted a school board member as saying that she was sent by God to ensure that some minority, that means gays, right, LGBTQ, will not infiltrate, I think is the word you used, our schools. Here we go again. I'm going to get on this soapbox one more time. The bigotry comes in a number of different forms. There's the belief that the other is inferior and therefore can be subjugated and used because they're subhuman. They're not as there's something inferior about them. Right? That's one form of bigotry that leads to subjugation. There's another form of bigotry that simply holds that the other is just strange, right? I don't understand their culture. I don't understand their ways. There's something about them that makes me feel uncomfortable. They're strange. So they have to be excluded. So that's another type, right? There's subjugation. There's exclusion. They're not the same thing. Then there's this form of bigotry, right? This
you know,
group of people.
But can I say something here? I want to plug something in while you're talking about it. I'm a Jew, but I understand who Jesus Christ was. Okay, mm-hmm. I understand what he was. I may not accept him as the Messiah, but I understand what his teachings are, at least according to what the New Testament says. Where in any of that do Christians believe that Jesus himself would sanction the things they say, the things they do, and the bigotry that they show? Where in all of those teachings is any of that? And I don't want to hear about Genesis and you shall not spill thy seed upon the ground and all that kind of stuff, okay? Because that's just minuscule stuff. That has nothing to do with what you are doing to children and teenagers today. How you teach about the others because somehow you feel your religion is being threatened. and your whiteness is being threatened. So you pick on anybody and everybody. In the name of God. Not my God. Not my God. And children die and you don't care. You don't care. You teach your children to be mean and bully children that are different than they are. I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, and they're working hard on the most dangerous type of bigotry, because we've talked so far about subjugating people and excluding people. Well, now let's get to the most dangerous kind, and that is where you teach others that this other group, whatever it is not necessarily inferior and is not necessarily strange. What it is dangerous. It's a threat. And when you read Mein Kampf, that's what that book was about. Among other things, obviously, you know, morally inferior. Of course, all of that stuff was in there. But Hitler talked about other people as though they were, quote, unquote, a virus. They infect. They infiltrate. Did you hear that word? They infiltrate. They take over.
Those are the
they
words
groom.
That he used.
Yeah. They groom. They do.
Yes.
Now, what language are you hearing out of Republicans about gays? Right. And this school board member says, I'm not going to let some minority infiltrate. Okay. Now the message is this group, you know, we're not talking about a group that's inferior. We're not talking about a group that's just strange, although, of course, they think it is. We're talking about a group that is dangerous. And now the other becomes a problem that needs to be solved, in case that language rings relevant. That's what they're doing here. They're playing with fire, and they're going to cost people their lives. And they don't care, as you just said. They just don't care. It's a party of life.
They literally do not care. There's no question. They literally do not care. And I don't know what we do about it, other than try to teach our children not to be that way, but I don't know how you're going to teach them how not to be that way when you're teaching them just the wrong things. And I blame to a certain extent the religious leaders, because they're the ones that are teaching it in their Sunday mm-hmm. schools and teaching them this is what our religion believes. It's a real problem. It really is. I know we've run out of time. But there are two things that I wanted to save for next week. I'm going to save this so that I don't forget. No, John, mm-hmm. Talking about John Kennedy of Louisiana is a subject matter that I will talk about, and how he literally basically insulted the whole country of Mexico and everybody mm-hmm. that lives there. And then there's the issue, which is coming to a head, which we'll be able to talk about next week, on the new law that was the immigration law. I don't know where the state of Florida gets off passing an immigration law, but I think it's a little unconstitutional, but they passed an immigration law that says it's a felony to bring anyone who is an undocumented alien, as they put it, into the state of Florida. And now there are truck drivers who are refusing to make deliveries in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
People who are Latin in descent are refusing to drive their trucks into the state of Florida and make deliveries here. And that's going to come back to bite them in the you-know-what. So those are two subjects we can talk about next week, but I want to give a little preview.
Yep.
I just found that stuff, and I just think it's worth talking about.
It is. It is.
Hezzy, as usual, thank you.
Well,
and
thank you.
Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Hezzy.
And you do the same, both of you.
Yeah.
We always worry about the Hez. And let me know what's going on with the platform, because if we have to make a move.
Well,
okay?
You don't need to. You wouldn't need to. I'll take care of that. Not a problem.
I'm leaving it up to you. Okay?
Okay.
Everyone have
a wonderful
week. And it's just,
yep.
you know, hope that nothing awful continues to happen. Okay? Talk to you soon, Brent.
All right. Have a good one. It's been a pleasure.
Take care, Brent.
Take care, everybody.
Take care, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, goodness. It doesn't get better than these two guys. What a pleasure. Brendan Beery, Jeffrey Swartz. Just terrific. Well, let's think about what else is going on the world stage, and there is a lot. I guess one of the things that's really quite interesting is that supposedly after the Arab League summit, the United Arab Emirate has invited Syria's president to the COP28. So the question is, are they out of the cold? Well, Syria's embattled President Bashar Assad received an invitation to attend the upcoming COP28 climate talks in Dubai later this year, even as the years-long war in his country over his rule grinds on. So Assad's invitation late Monday to the climate talks comes as the Syrian president already is scheduled to attend the Arab League summit this Friday in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, years after being frozen out of regional politics. A brutal crackdown by Assad's government on demonstrators in the 2011 Arab Spring uprising challenging his rule descended into a civil war and consequently became a regional conflict. The war has killed off 1 million people and displaced half of its population. Now, Assad's invitation came in a letter from Emirati leader Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Syria's state-run Sana news agency had reported. Well, the agency published images of Assad reading the letter alongside an Emirati diplomat in Damascus, the capital of Syria. The United Arab Emirates similarly had cut ties with Assad only to slowly restore them in recent years. Asked for comment, the Emirati office organizing the upcoming climate conference said in a statement that the event marked, quote, a milestone opportunity for the world to come together, course correct, and drive progress towards keeping the goals and ambitions of the Paris Climate Agreement alive, end quote. Well, COP28 is committed to an inclusive COP process that produces transformational solutions, the statement added. This can only happen if we have everyone in the room. Well, Syria is both a party to the Paris Climate Agreement, as well as the Kyoto Protocol, and scientists have linked a drought in Syria that began in 2007 to climate change, saying that it likely played in the conflict. However, Assad's invitation will probably heighten scrutiny of the Emirates ahead of hosting the talks. Already, activists have criticized the United Arab Emirates for nominating the head of its dominant state oil company as the president of the talks. And that company has plans to boost its production of both crude oil and natural gas, fossil fuels that produce more of the heat-trapping carbon dioxide that the United Nations negotiations hope to limit. But the oil chief himself, Sultan Al-Jaber, had also helped oversee the Emirates pledging tens of billions of dollars towards renewable energy projects worldwide. The Conference of the Parties, where COP gets its name, will be held at Dubai's Expo City from November 30 through December 12th. So we'll just have to see where all that goes. Now, this is interesting as well. Saudi Arabia and Syria have restored diplomatic ties after nearly a decade. Well, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad cemented his return to the Arab fold on Tuesday when leading Sunni power Saudi Arabia, which long supported Syria's opposition, said its diplomats would resume talk and work in the country. The restoration of diplomatic ties, later confirmed by Damascus, came more than a decade after Riyadh withdrew its representatives during Syria's civil war, and 2 days after the Arab League bloc ended Syria's years-long suspension. Now, the kingdom, quote, has decided to resume the work of its diplomatic mission in Syria, Riyadh's foreign ministry said in a statement carried by the official Saudi press agency, saying it would seek to develop joint Arab action, quote unquote. Syria's Sana, S-A-N-A, news agency also said, quote, that the Syrian Arab Republic has decided to resume the work of its diplomatic mission in Saudi Arabia, end quote, quoting a foreign ministry source. And Saudi Arabia will host the Pan-Arab bloc's next summit on May 19th, just a few days away. Assad had been politically isolated in the region since Syria's war began, but a flurry of diplomatic activity has been underway in past weeks after a decision by Saudi Arabia and Iran, a close ally of Damascus, to resume ties shifted the political landscape. And 3 weeks ago, Assad met in Damascus with Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Fahan, the first such visit since the war broke out in 2011. Well, at that time, Assad and Prince Faisal discussed steps to, quote, achieve a comprehensive political settlement that contributes to Syria's return to the Arab fold, end quote, the foreign ministry of Saudi Arabia had said. Saudi Arabia severed ties with Assad's government in 2012, and Riyadh had long openly championed Assad's ouster, backing Syrian rebels in earlier stages of the war. Assad hopes that normalization with wealthy Gulf states can bring economic relief and money for reconstruction, as broader international funding remains elusive without a United Nations-backed political settlement to the conflict. But there's no political solution. On Sunday, the Arab League welcomed back Syria's government. The body had suspended Damascus in November 2011 over its crackdown on peaceful protests, which had begun earlier that year and spiraled into a war that drew in foreign powers, has killed more than 500,000 people, displaced millions, and battered the country's infrastructure and industry, while the front lines have mostly quieted. Large parts of the country's north remain outside government control, and no political solution has yet been reached to the conflict. Arab League foreign ministers on Sunday emphasized their keenness, quote, end quote, to launch a leading Arab role in efforts to resolve the Syria crisis. Ahmed Abu Hayt, the head of the 22-member Arab League, said that the decision, quote, brings the Arab side into communication with the Syrian government for the first time in years, end quote. Syria's return to the bloc is, quote, the beginning, not the end of the issue, end quote. He added, noting that it was up to individual countries to decide whether to resume ties with Damascus. The Syrian National Coalition, the main opposition alliance, said that Sunday's decision meant, quote, abandoning, end quote, Syrians and leaving them, quote, without official Arab support, end quote. The United States and Britain said they still oppose relations with Assad, but would work with Arab states that are reestablishing relations. Quote, and our position is clear. We are not going to be in the business of normalizing relations with Assad and with that regime, end quote, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, told reporters in Washington. But Blinken said the United States shared the goals of Arab partners in Syria, including on providing humanitarian assistance and combating the Islamic State extremist group. Quote, so I think the Arab perspective, as articulated through the Arab League, is they believe that they can pursue these objectives through more direct engagement, Blinken had said. British Foreign Minister Secretary James Cleverly, speaking alongside Blinken, said that London was, quote, very uncomfortable, end quote, with the Arab League decision. Quote, we cannot just wish away the actions of the Assad regime over the last few years. The brutality against Syrian people cannot just be ignored, and the United Kingdom certainly won't brush that under the carpet, Cleverly had said. Quote, but we do recognize that there is a huge amount of pressure on countries in the region, he said. The United States maintains hundreds of soldiers in Syria as part of a coalition against the Islamic State group. Turkish and Iranian-linked forces are also in the country. So, as you could see, there's a lot going on. you know, it just is what it is. And it's very, very frightening, to say the least. Well, let's look at some good news, which I think you'll find interesting. Bear with me a second. Ryanair has ordered 300 Boeing 737 MAX jets worth, are you sitting down, $40 billion. Irish airline Ryanair today ordered 300 Boeing 737 MAX jets worth over $40 billion at list prices, representing the United States aerospace giant's latest big contract in a fast-recovering aviation market. The announcement, comprising 150 firm orders plus 150 options for new fuel-efficient aircraft, represents, quote, the largest order ever placed for the U.S. manufactured goods, said a statement from Ryanair, which is eyeing big growth over the next decade. Well, the jets are set for delivery between 2027 and 2033. While airlines traditionally negotiate substantial discounts on list prices, especially for big orders. Executive did not release the financial details of the transaction, but Ryanair Chief Executive Michael O'Leary described the agreement as a win-win, quote-unquote, in an interview with Agence France-Presse held jointly with Boeing Chief Executive Dave Calhoun. The Dublin-based carrier said that the deal would be subject to shareholder approval at its annual general meeting in September, owing to the size and scale of the transaction. Well, the announcement is the latest lift for Boeing, which is emerging from a major slump due to the COVID-19 downturn and the lengthy grounding of the 737 MAX after two fatal crashes. The orders cover Boeing's new 737 MAX 10 aircraft, which have 228 seats, about 20% more than the current generation of comparable Boeing jets, O'Leary had said. At a signing event at Boeing's Arlington, Virginia headquarters, O'Leary added that the new aircraft, quote, boasts lower costs, end quote, that will be passed on in the form of lower airfares throughout driving our growth, end quote, he said. Ryanair added that the new 228-passenger seat jets, alongside a major recruitment drive, would help facilitate a surge in passenger numbers. The carrier, which specializes in competitively priced short and medium distance trips within Europe, is targeting an 80% jump in annual passenger traffic to 300 million travelers by 2034 compared with 2023 to recruit more than 10,000 new cabin crew members, engineers and pilots to help meet the goal. The company hopes to garner a 30% share of the European market. It's like a marriage. O'Leary has been known to publicly criticize Boeing in the past over plane delivery delays, as in May 2022, when he said Boeing management were, quote, running around like headless chickens, end quote. But on Tuesday, O'Leary said the relationship with the United States company was, quote, a bit like a marriage. We have occasional rows and occasional splits, and then we come together and then kiss and make up, end quote. He added that Boeing has been on time with 90 to 95% of its deliveries over the years. He downplayed the impact of a recent halt in MAX deliveries due to an issue with a Boeing supplier, saying the hit would be, quote, reasonably small, end quote, on Ryanair's summer travel, and it would not cancel any routes. Well, Calhoun also spoke warmly about the relationship, recalling that the Irish carrier was the first customer to sign a major order following the MAX grounding in December of 2020, shortly after the aircraft was cleared by U.S. officials to resume service. That announcement, quote, told me everything I need to know about the Ryanair relationship and the model, end quote, Calhoun said at a press conference. Calhoun, in the joint Agence France-Presse interview with O'Leary, said he was confident that Boeing would meet the terms of the contract. When Boeing presented its long-term outlook last November, the American manufacturer anticipated the logistics difficulties that have dogged the industry during the pandemic, quote, we would improve themselves over the next two calendar years, 2023 and 24, Calhoun had said. And that is what's been happening, he said. He also characterized the Federal Aviation Administration certification process for the MAX 10 as on track. No technical issues have arisen such that there's a concern that we won't be able to resolve, Calhoun said. It's documentation, 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 quote unquote. And shares of Boeing ended 2.3% higher in New York, while Ryanair gained 3.6% in Dublin. Absolutely fascinating what's going on, but a worthy note for sure. Now, let's look at some other things. Well, evidently, I think, let me just check this out. Bear with me a second here. Turkey voted in the key presidential and legislative elections this past Sunday that could either extend President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's two-decade grip on power or put the nation on a more liberal, secular course. According to state-run news agency Anadolu, turnout reached 88.47% in what has effectively turned into a referendum on Turkey's longest-serving leader and his Islamic Conservative Justice and Development Party, the AKP. And so Turkey appears headed for a runoff presidential election after neither Tayyip Erdogan nor rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu cleared the 50% threshold to win outright on Sunday. According to Turkey's state-owned news agency Anadolu, Erdogan led with 49.86% and Kılıçdaroğlu had 44.38% with almost 91% of ballot boxes counted. While speaking to supporters in Ankara, Erdogan said he still hoped to win Sunday's vote but would accept a second round if necessary. We don't yet know if the elections ended in the first round. If our nation has chosen for a second round, that is also welcome, he said. Kılıçdaroğlu also said on Monday that he would accept the people's decision for a second round of voting, quote, if our nation says second round, we will absolutely win in the second round, end quote, he told reporters. While Erdogan is seeking a third term that would extend his two decades in power, six opposition parties have united behind Kılıçdaroğlu, hoping the center-left civil servant has a chance of unseating the Turkish strongman. And far-right challenger Sinan Ogan is backed by four nationalists. Ahead of the vote, opposition hopes were high amid widespread anger over inflation, which is near 50%, and frustration over delayed relief efforts following February's devastating earthquakes. But Erdogan has a strong support base in many parts of the country. The elections are being watched intently in Western capitals, the Middle East, and Moscow, as well as by other NATO members. Erdogan has become one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's closest allies while drifting away from Western allies. So Turkey's Erdogan says he could still win, but would accept the runoff. Kılıçdaroğlu says he will accept the people's decision for a runoff. So we'll see where all this goes. And we'll see. At the end of the day, it seems that Erdogan's support fell under 50% as the count continued. So this is going to definitely go forward, and we will have a new election process on the 28th. So we'll have to see where all this ends. Very, very exciting, and a nerve, you know, a nail biter, as they say. So really quite problematic for a lot of people who are just watching what's going on. So let's just take a couple of other things to see what else is happening. Evidently, there's a Ukraine update. Heavy Russian air raid has been repelled, Kiev says. Ukrainian air defenses largely repelled a heavy Russian missile attack overnight, Kiev had said. European leaders are gathering for a Council of Europe summit, the first in years, to discuss the war. And Deutsche Welle has the latest information. Well, Russia launched a fresh wave of air attacks, the 8th in May, on the Ukrainian capital early on Tuesday. Ukrainian officials said the defense systems had shot down objects over several districts of Kyiv, although Russian defense officials later said they had hit all targets overnight. Well, the night attack was complex, with drones, crews and likely ballistic missiles launched from different directions, Kyiv officials said. Quote, it was exceptional in its density, the maximum number of attack missiles in the shortest period of time, Serhiy Popko, the head of Kyiv's city military administration, said in a post commented on the Telegram messaging application. Well, quote, according to preliminary information, the vast majority of enemy targets in the airspace of Kyiv were detected and destroyed, he added. So Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov said in a tweet that, quote, our sky defenders shot down six Russian hypersonic Kinzhal missiles and 12 other missiles during the Russian attacks. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko earlier said that falling debris set several cars on fire and damaged a building in the Solomyansky district in the capital's west, which appeared to be the hardest hit. Three people were injured. Two cars caught fire in the city's southeastern Donetsky district, he added, and debris also fell on the city's zoo in the Shevchenkivsky district. And Kyiv's military administration said that fallen debris was reported in the capital's Oblonsky, Shevchenkivsky, Solomyansky, and Donetsky districts. After a weeks-long hiatus, Russia in late April resumed its tactic of long-range missile strikes and has launched a flurry of attacks in recent days, often targeting Kyiv. The capital of all of Ukraine was under air raid alerts in early hours this morning. The latest attacks came just hours after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky returned from a Europe trip aimed at securing new weapons for a planned counteroffensive against Russia. Russia says it hit all the targets overnight, at direct odds with Kyiv's assertion that it had successfully repelled an overnight missile barrage. Russia said its military hit all targets. Kyiv earlier announced it had downed nearly 20 Russian missiles. The Defense Ministry in Moscow said long-range precision strike missiles had targeted facilities storing Western-supplied ammunition, weapons, and military equipment. Well, the Ukraine commander says that Bakhmut is a mousetrap for Russians. The commander of Ukraine's land forces, Oleksandr Styrsky, has described the embattled town of Bakhmut as a trap for Russian troops. The Wagner mercenaries crawled into Bakhmut like rats into a mousetrap, Styrsky said during a visit to the frontline area. Ukrainian units had been able to stage counterattacks several sections near Bakhmut through, quote, active defense, end quote, he added. Quote, the enemy has more resources, but we are destroying their plans, the commander had said. Ukraine forces say they have pushed Russian troops back to the north and southwest of Bakhmut, in some cases by several kilometers. However, the head of the Russian Wagner group of mercenaries, Yevgeny Prigozhin, still claims he is making progress in conquering the last street in the city of Bakhmut. Prigozhin on Tuesday published a video showing parts on a map he said were still held by Ukrainian troops. The town of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region was once home to more than 70,000 people. It had been at the epicenter of fighting for months, and the battle for it is the bloodiest and longest of the war so far. And then now we hear that Ukraine's First Lady is seeking more backing from Seoul. Ukrainian First Lady Olena Zelenska has met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol in Seoul as a special representative of her husband, President Volodymyr Zelensky. South Korea's Yonhap news agency said that Zelenska had said she was seeking, quote, more radical, end quote, backing for Ukraine in its fight against Russia. Tech-savvy South Korea is the world's ninth largest arms exporter and has sent humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. While it has, quote, sold tanks and howitzers to Poland, the Asian country, which has a longstanding policy of not providing weapons to active conflict zones, has not provided them to Ukraine. Speaking to Yonhap, Zelenska said that Ukraine was, quote, always waiting for its friends, end quote, when asked if Kiev planned to invite Yoon to Kiev. Quote, such a visit would be very supportive to Ukrainians because it is a way to share our confrontation with us, at least for a day of our lives, the agency reported Zelenska as saying. European leaders are gathering for a Council of Europe summit for the first time in years. European leaders are gathering in Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, for a two-day summit on the war in Ukraine. The meeting called by the Council of Europe is the first one to be held by the organization in nearly two decades. The Strasbourg-based organization doesn't have the same high-stakes profile as the European Union, but it has been a guardian of human rights and the rule of law on the continent. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni are among the leading leaders expected to attend the summit. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, European Council President Charles Michel, and officials from the United Nations will also attend the gathering. The Council of Europe was founded in 1949 and has 46 members, including Turkey, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom. Now we hear about the U.S. Abrams tanks that landed Germany for Ukrainian training. The 31 tanks the United States promised earlier this year to deliver to Ukraine have arrived at a military training center in Germany, the U.S. Defense Department had said. I can confirm that the 31 M1 Abrams training tanks have arrived at Grafenwöhr in Germany in preparation for subsequent training of Ukrainian tank crews. Pentagon spokesman Pat Ryder said in Washington, Grafenwöhr in northern Bavaria is home to a U.S. military training base. Ryder said that Ukrainian crews were expected to arrive and begin training within the next couple of weeks. Quote, as we've discussed previously, this extensive training program for Ukrainian crews and maintainers is intended to prepare them for their critical role ahead in effectively operating the M1 tank and defending Ukrainian people, he said. The long-awaited decision to send 31 U.S. tanks to Ukraine was made back in January in conjunction with Germany's drawn-out decision on whether or not to send Kiev Leopard main battle tanks. Well, the Ukrainian government doesn't want its athletes competing against Russians, but some think that sends out the wrong message and risks surrendering the platform of the international sport to Russian propaganda. So that's one of the latest bits of information that you might want to know about. Now, let's just quickly look at some other issues. And this is really quite compelling. Question is, how is India looking at Pakistan's political crisis? India needs political stability in Pakistan for any kind of a dialogue with its regional arch rival. With Pakistan deeply divided, India has no strong political partner for talks in Islamabad. Earlier this month, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari visited India to participate in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO conference. Although he briefly met with his Indian counterpart, S. Jaishankar, on the meeting's sidelines. The two diplomats did not engage in any formal discussion, and they never held a meeting. Some experts describe it as a, quote, missed opportunity, end quote, for Pakistan to improve relations with India, but others claim that Pakistan's Bhutto Zardari could not have done much more, even if he wanted to. Quote, Bhutto Zardari came to India with his hands tied behind his back in terms of diplomatic space for any initiative on the bilateral front. Domestic politics in Pakistan will not allow him to reach out in any substantive way. Ajay Basaria, a former India High Commissioner to Pakistan, advised Deutsche Welle. So what's happening in Pakistan? The political crisis in Pakistan has only worsened in the days following the FCO summit. On May 9, the paramilitary forces arrested former Prime Minister Imran Khan in Islamabad, triggering a violent unrest across the country. Several people were killed as Khan supporters took to the streets to protest against the current government and Pakistan's military. Khan was eventually released by the country's top court. Pakistan is still reeling from the aftermath. The army has condemned the violence and vowed to try the perpetrators in military courts. If this happens, Khan and his Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf PTI party could face a political ban. The Muslim majority country has been in a state of political turmoil since Khan was removed by the parliament in a no-confidence vote last April. The incumbent Pakistan Democratic Movement, the PDM, a coalition government headed by Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, is grappling with a worsening economic crisis and is struggling to obtain a loan from the International Monetary Fund to avoid a possible default. Well, there is no strong player in Pakistan right now. Across the border, the Indian government is watching the events unfold in Pakistan, seemingly without much trepidation. The current crisis in Pakistan, in my view, reaffirms the policy direction put in place by the Indian government, a studied aloofness or low-grade hostility. Amit Julka, an assistant professor of international relations at Ashoka University in New Delhi, told Deutsche Welle. And yet, the crisis leaves New Delhi without a partner, a credible stakeholder within the Pakistani government. Quote, the civilian government in Pakistan has lost its legitimacy due to economic problems, and the military stands discredited and is quite confused about its own direction, Julka had said. Stuti Bhatnagar, a research fellow at the Australian National University, said that while the domestic crisis in Pakistan are alarming, it is unlikely that they would have any an impact on the ties between India and Pakistan. She pointed out that the relationship between the two neighboring countries has been steadily declining for the past few years, quote, with few opportunities for dialogue and the lack of any political consensus on the resumption of dialogue, particularly in India, end quote. And now we have to reflect on the longstanding disputes. The ties between the two South Asian rivals have been troubled ever since both countries gained independence from British rule in 1947, and a 2019 terror attack on Indian troops in Kashmir increased tensions even further. Both nations claim the disputed Kashmir region in its entirety, but each rule only parts of it. New Delhi, which accuses Islamabad of backing Islamist and separatist in India-administered Kashmir, 2019 attack on Pakistan. In the same year, New Delhi revoked the special constitutional status enjoyed by the part of Kashmir it controls, further angering Islamabad. Despite these horny issues, analysts say the Pakistani Foreign Ministry's decision to visit India in May was a positive development. Bhutto Zardari himself was cautious about the implication of his trip, as his political rival Kari's party had already accused him of compromising on the Kashmir root cause, end quote. Well, given the situation in Pakistan, expectations from Bhutto Zardari's India were grossly misplaced, and this was amply demonstrated by the events that followed. Sarat Sabharwal, a former Indian High Commissioner to Pakistan, advised. Bear with me a moment because it looks like we have a caller. So let's bring in the caller. Good morning, caller. Did you have a question or a statement?
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
I'm a little bit concerned about the concept here.
What concept are you concerned about?
Is it just the dynamic, the way that you guys are doing this?
The dynamics of whether we're what? I didn't hear you. Okay. I don't know what the caller was talking about because he never finished his thought and he hung up. So don't understand exactly what's going on. Anyway, New Delhi continues to accuse Pakistan of sponsoring terrorism in the region, a claim Islamabad vehemently denies. So while Bhutto Zardari brought up the security situation in Kashmir in conversation with Indian media during his Goa visit, his Indian colleague Jaishankar repeated the claim. Bhatnagar said that Narendra Modi's policies, quote, go against any political or diplomatic concession to Pakistan, end quote. The instability in Pakistan feeds further into this discourse and heightens India's security concerns, end quote, she said. Continuing, she said, the current political and economic turmoil in Pakistan will give impetus to hardliners in India who continue to blame political instability in Pakistan and the overwhelmingly dominant role of the Pakistan military in abetting acts of terrorism against India, she added. Well, Indian diplomat Sabharwal believes India will need to wait for things to settle down and on and go through its own election cycle in 2024 before real progress can be made. Thereafter, there may be opportunities to stabilize the relationship by restoring diplomatic relations to the High Commissioner level and resuming trade, quote unquote. Analyst Julka says that India and Pakistan need a new regional framework and a political vision that goes beyond narrow nationalism to ameliorate ties. However, due to the ruling Hindu nationalist party's use of foreign policy for domestic legitimacy, India is likely to continue its aloof posturing to project strength and stability against its unstable neighbor, he added. Now, let me just quickly look and check some other issues. Bear with me a moment. We'll see what else we haven't covered for you on the international stage. Bear with me a moment here. This you'll find interesting, especially if you're considering going abroad. Germany's Deutsche Bahn, the German rail system, is battling a crisis amid its 49 euro ticket launch. These are German trains were once synonymous with efficiency. Now the state railway Deutsche Bahn is beset by woes. Can it get back on track is a big question. It remains one of the most enduring cliches about Germany for those who don't live there. The trains run on time. Except they don't, and haven't for quite some time. Last year, one-third of trains from Deutsche Bahn, DB, Germany's state-owned rail company, were late. That figure has been steadily rising for years. It's not just passengers who are affected. Some of Europe's biggest logistics companies have repeatedly called out Deutsche Bahn's freight and cargo business in recent years for its persistent delays. Tardiness is not the only problem. The company has been consistently posting losses in recent years and is currently more than $32.6 billion in debt. Passengers routinely complain of overcrowded trains and expensive tickets. The company has also been beset by industrial disputes. A 50-hour strike by railway workers due to begin on May 14, which was a few days ago, was called off at the last minute the day before EVG, the union, behind the strike says the negotiations on wage increases are ongoing. Strikes in March and April already caused significant disruption. The company itself has no illusions about the scale of the problem. The current operational situation is not acceptable for us, travelers, or railway companies, a Deutsche Bahn spokesperson advised Deutsche Welle. So the question is, what's the problem? Jan Wirth, a railway transport analyst resident in Berlin, says that Germany's railways are in a delicate situation, quote unquote. He says the main problem is widely acknowledged, a lack of investment in infrastructure. Railway, quote, railway in Germany are at the limit, he told Deutsche Welle. Germany runs a lot of trains on very old and decrepit infrastructure and has simply not been investing in the tracks, the bridges, and the signals as much as would be necessary in order to manage to run things with a stable and reliable service. Carl Peter Naumann, the honorary chairman of the public transport advocacy group PRO-Bahn, agrees that outdated infrastructure is the main problem. Quote, customers, that means punctuality, and as a direct result, misconnecting trains, he told Deutsche Welle. As well as infrastructure not being upgraded, much has been actively dismantled without being replaced. The total length of the railway network has been reduced by around 20% since 1994. The number of railway switches, which enabled trains to move from one track to another, was also significantly reduced. Wirth says this leads to another problem, namely that rail networks are filled to capacity. So when one train breaks down, it can create major ripple effects across the network. Deutsche Bahn concedes that a lack of infrastructure is the main problem. A company spokesperson told Deutsche Welle that years of insufficient funding combined with a surge in passenger demand have brought the company's problems to a head. Quote, the rail network can no longer cope, end quote, the spokesperson said. In part, it is too old, too prone to failure, and has too little capacity, end quote. The question is, who's to blame? Responsibility for the lack of investment goes back a few decades, according to Wirth. Ultimately, the problem stemmed from decisions made a good 20 years ago, he said. Baumann agrees, quote, too little has been invested in the expansion and maintenance of the rail infrastructure in the last 30 years. This March, Germany's Federal Court of Audit released a damning report that heavily criticized successive German governments and Deutsche Bahn itself for what it referred to as the company's permanent crisis, quote unquote. It decried the company's financial situation, saying that its debt, which stands at more than 30 billion euros, had increased by an average of 5 billion euro per day since 2016, five million euros per day since 2016. So while the report was critical of the company itself, particularly the fact that Deutsche Bahn's structure made it hard for the government to scrutinize and manage it properly, it emphasized that decisive government action was immediately needed to stop the problem spiraling out of control. Quote, fundamental reforms are required to ensure that the railway system is able to meet its transport and climate policy role, Federal Court of Audit President Kay Scheller had said. So what's going to be done, and can it get better? Amid all the criticism, Deutsche Bahn and the government have taken steps to begin addressing these persistent problems. In March of 2023, the government pledged to invest 45 billion euros in Deutsche Bahn by 2027. Revitalizing and retrofitting the company's network is now a key plank of the government's plans to achieve climate neutrality by 2045. By 2030, a real high-performance network will be created, a Deutsche Bahn spokesman advised Deutsche Welle. Another initiative Deutsche Bahn hopes will win favor is its recently launched 49 euro monthly ticket. The ticket, which costs 49 euros per month, as the name suggests, will cover regional rail, metro, tram, and bus networks nationwide and is aimed and getting more people to use public transportation. Wirth says that Deutsche Bahn is trying to upgrade its infrastructure, pointing to the wholesale innovation of the Frankfurt-Mannheim line, as well as the purchase of a new fleet of high-speed ICE3 NEO trains for long-distance travel. See, we've got another caller. Let's see what the caller has to say. Good morning, caller. Is there anything you'd like to say or ask a question about? Okay, you just want to listen? Is that it? Okay, no problem. We'll put you in our queue. Bear with me. So you can just listen in. The company insists it's now turning a corner. It told Deutsche Welle it's rapidly upgrading its infrastructure on a daily basis, including detour routes to limit the hit to punctuality when main routes are disrupted. It says that climate-friendly mobility is booming and that it expects a record number of long-distance travelers in 2023. Quote, this spurs us to become better for our customers as quickly as possible because Germany deserves a railway that is more efficient and punctual, the spokesperson had said. That's the issue there. Bear with me a moment. Let me just check if we can get to where I want to get to on the website, but I think not functioning. Oh, it is. Thank goodness for that. Bear with me a moment here. Move on here. Okay, bear with me a second here. See if we can get through to this, then we'll be fine. One moment. No, evidently not. I was trying to get to the website, but evidently could not. So not good. All right, let's move on to something else. One moment here. One second. This is interesting as well. We're going to France. Evidently, homophobic attacks in France rose almost 30% last year. So says an LGBTQ group. Last year saw an increase in gay and trans people reporting physical attacks in France, an activist group said on Tuesday, warning that anti-LGBTQ sentiment remains anchored in society. So SOS Homophobie, or SOS Homophobia, said in a report that it received just over 1,500 reports of homophobic or other discriminatory behavior in 2022 via its website and hotline, around the same number as the previous year. But there was a 28% increase in reports of physical attacks to 184, or roughly one every 2 days. Now, despite developments in the law and in people's attitudes towards LGBTQ people, still can't live freely the way they are. SOS Homophobie Chief Yoel Demure advised Agence France-Presse. So in its report, the group said that violent acts against gay and trans people included, quote, ambushes set up using dating apps, quote, unquote, and often had, quote, superficial or non-existent motives, end quote. Among the reports they received were a knife attack on a male couple in the metro, the underground, two women finding their car had been repeatedly spat on, a young man battered by five attackers, and another told by his neighbor that your kind doesn't deserve to live, end quote. Reports of discrimination included as a real estate agent refusing to sell or rent to LGBTQ couples or families, and public spaces like shops and libraries refusing entry to non-binary or trans individuals. SOS Homophobie highlighted reports of transphobic incidents, which it said had increased by 26% since last year to 227. Schools especially, quote, often refuse any kind of administrative changes, quote, end quote, to pupils' genders, the association complained. And SOC Homophobie urged the government to launch a, quote, national awareness campaign, end quote, dedicated and dedicate more resources to investigating homophobic and transphobic crimes and improve training for police, some of whom still refuse to accept such complaints. So it's going to be really unbelievable. Last, a message for the day. Biden evidently signed the same-sex and interracial marriage protection into U.S. law. Well, U.S. President Joe Biden today signed into law a bill granting federal protection to same-sex marriage, with a large crowd of guests gathering at the White House to celebrate the legislative milestone. Biden, who, as vice president, took a public stand in favor of same-sex unions well before they became legal throughout the United States in a 2015 Supreme Court decision, touted the landmark law as a rights victory. Well, America takes a vital step towards equality for liberty and justice, not just for some, but for everyone, he said during the signing ceremony Tuesday afternoon, after the U.S. Supreme Court, now significantly more conservative, overturned longstanding abortion rights last June. Lawmakers from the left and right came together to prevent any subsequent move to curb same-sex marriage rights. Legislation's final adoption by Congress last week marked a rare show of bipartisanship in deeply divided Washington. In celebration, Biden gathered with a group of Republican and Democratic lawmakers on the White House grounds, along with advocates and plaintiffs in marriage equality cases across the country. Tammy Baldwin, the first openly gay U.S. senator, said she was, quote, overcome with joy, end quote, at the signing of the law, which she helped draft in Congress. Quote, today we are making history and making a difference for millions of Americans, end quote, she said in a statement. Quote, we are telling the millions of same-sex and interracial couples that we see them and we respect them, end quote. Legislation, White House spokesperson Karine Jean said on Monday, quote, will give peace of mind to millions of LGBTQI+ and interracial couples who will finally be guaranteed the rights and protection to which they and their children are entitled. Jean-Pierre herself made history as the first openly gay White House press secretary. Hundreds of thousands of same-sex couples have married since the Supreme Court's 2015 decision legalizing the unions throughout the United States. public acceptance has grown dramatically in recent decades, with polls now showing a strong majority of Americans supporting same-sex marriage. But some conservatives and the religious right remain opposed. The new legislation, known as the Respect for Marriage Act, does not mandate states to legalize same-sex marriage, but does require them to recognize a marriage so long as it was valid in the state where it was performed. It repeals previous legislation defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman, and also protects interracial couples by requiring states to recognize legal marriages without regard to sex, race, ethnicity, or national origin. So in the House of Representatives, 39 Republicans joined a united Democratic majority in supporting the bill, while 169 Republicans voted against it. It was previously adopted in the evenly split Senate by 61 votes to 36. Now work's got to be done, so Jean-Pierre said on Monday, that Biden believes there is much more work to be done to protect LGBTQI+ individuals across the country. She recalled that the 80-year-old Democrat was among the first American political leaders to publicly support same-sex unions at the highest levels of government. So that is a story that's as much time as we have. We have to say goodbye and thank you for being with us, that's for sure. So all the best and take care. Goodbye. Bear with me a second here. We're going to end the episode now. Bye.